I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Last week, the sound from the Capitol was of people in both houses of Congress coping with the cost of Iraq.
It's hypocrisy. How can we ask other countries to give money when ours is in the form of a loan?
It's very hard for me to go home and explain how you have to give $20 billion to a country that's sitting on $1 trillion worth of oil.
We were told Iraq could pay for its own reconstruction. It cannot. And we were told that the war were to make America safer. It has not.
Let's don't get off track tonight by leaving the impression with the Iraqi people that we came into the country to help them and then to send them a bill for it.
We owe it to our taxpayers to be just as concerned about growing our budget deficit as we are about Iraq's deficit.
By the end of the week, both houses had given the go-ahead for the Bush administration's $87 billion request. However, senior Democrats and Republicans are still raising questions about the way the money is going to be spent. Senators Joseph Biden and Chuck Hagel are with us this hour to answer questions about what's next in Iraq. Connection listeners, have you accepted the administration's price tag? And what timeline would you like to see for handing over control to Iraqis and for bringing American soldiers home? What do you expect from Congress in keeping tabs on the administration's efforts in Iraq? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Senator Joseph Biden from Delaware is the lead Democrat on the committee. He is with us from a studio in Wilmington. Welcome to the program, Senator.
Thank you for having me.
And Senator Chuck Hagel is the number two Republican on the committee. He's joining us from his office in Omaha. Senator, welcome.
Good morning. Thank you.
Let me start with Senator Biden, but the same question to both of you. You're both home in your districts. Tell us what people are saying about the $87 billion in Iraq.
Well, they're not happy with it because, quite frankly, they were misled by the administration, notwithstanding what Senator Hagel and Lugar and myself and others kept saying a year ago, saying this was going to cost us billions of dollars without significant help going into the war, which we never got. And they were told by the administration things like you heard in what you played ahead of time, which was that there's plenty of Iraqi oil to pay for this when there was not, that this wasn't going to take that long, that we didn't need other people. The bottom line was they feel a little bit jilted. But I'd conclude this point by saying that, and Chuck has heard me say this, we're different parties, but Chuck has heard me say this on the floor, if the president's policy were working, if people had confidence in his policy in Iraq, you wouldn't have this debate over the $87 billion. It's a lot of money, but only $20 billion, $21 billion is for reconstruction. The other, we have no choice at all, $67 billion. It's costing us $4 billion a month to keep our troops there. And remember, they sacked General Shinseki for saying that we were going to have to do that. And so what this is really more about, in my view, is a loss of confidence in the policy. And people are wondering whether or not any of this will work. But I think it will work. I don't think it's too late. And I think the president's made a U-turn in his policy, rejecting Mr. Cheney and Rumsfeld's advice and moving toward away from unilateralism and toward internationalism. And I think there's hope. So I hope the attitude of the people will begin to change.
Senator Hagel, what are you hearing in Nebraska, Senator Hagel?
Well, not unlike what Senator Biden has just described that he is hearing in Delaware, there is a sense of uncertainty out here, and I think that is across the land. There is a very unsettled sense across the land. Certainly, I pick it up here in Nebraska. We are into something we've never been into before. We are getting in deeper and deeper, wider and wider, more troops, more money, more commitment, more leadership, more focus, more of our reputation on the line here. And that concerns people because they're not quite sure policy-wise that this is right, how it's been done so far. We lost two more of our young Americans yesterday. And this continues to go forward, and I think the real question in the minds of many Nebraskans, and I think the Americans as well as this develops, is can we and should we sustain this effort? Now, there's no question that most Americans, and my Nebraskans are no different, understand that we are living in some very dangerous times. And these new threats that confront the world today, terrorism, proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, need to be dealt with. but strong leadership that tells the truth, that says it straight, does not lead the Americans into some high expectation game and then can't fulfill those, are going to be required. And I think you are seeing some reactions to all of those right now. Now, I'd end by saying, if the administration comes back next year to the Congress for another significant supplemental appropriations request, as we passed, as you know, one in the spring for $79 billion, now we've just passed, well, we will come together with an $87 billion request. If they come back with another one, then I think you're going to find a Congress that's going to be a lot more difficult to deal with. And finally, I'd say, finally, the Congress is reasserting itself. We have stepped back over the last 2 years. I understand why, because of September 11, 2001. But the Congress now needs to play a very assertive role here.
I wonder if either of you feel, though, that in not playing that assertive role in the last 18 months, you didn't in some way create the circumstances that we're looking at now, that the administration felt in many ways that that it got something of a blank check from congressional representatives, from senators. I think, Senator Hagel, you said at one point that the Congress was treated as something of a nuisance by the administration. So, as senators, don't you two bear some responsibility for the situation that we're in right now?
Well, I'll respond first. I know Senator Biden has some very strong thoughts on this. But, yes, I agree. We have to take some responsibility for abdicating our constitutional responsibilities as well as our judgment responsibilities to the people we represent. I suspect much of that has been driven by what happened September 11, 2001. And what happens in this country throughout history, it has, is when America's security interests are threatened, the Congress, the people of the country, give the president great latitude, great range. And I think we've probably given this president more latitude, more flexibility than any president since Franklin Roosevelt. But that said, we now need to assert ourselves not in a negative way, but in a partnership way. We have a constitutional responsibility just like the president. Joe and I take the same oath of office that the president takes. My oath of office is not to swear allegiance to my president or to my party, but to the people I represent and to my country. So, yes, part of this responsibility rests on the shoulders of some timid leadership from the Congress and, quite frankly, lack of courage in the Congress.
You know, Mr. Gordon, it's Joe Biden. I agree with what Chuck said, but, you know, I've been there a long while for seven presidents, and what happens is that lots of times the Congress is left, the Senate in particular, on foreign policy with nothing but Hobbesian choices. The good choices are taken away by the president. Let me give you an example of what I mean. Prior to us going in, there was a resolution authorizing the use of force referred to as the Biden-Lugar Amendment that Senator Hagel and up to 24 Republicans were prepared to support, and the vast majority of the Democrats. And it was a much tighter constraint upon the president's use of force and the circumstances under which he could use the force and conditions set. But while that was all going on, we thought that the president was negotiating in good faith with us. We found out that there was a separate track negotiation going on over in the House of Representatives, which was essentially more latitude for the president. And as you notice, when that resolution was passed, you didn't see Chuck Hagel or Joe Biden or Dick Lugar standing in the Rose Garden for the signing of that resolution authorizing force. You did see some leading Democrats on the House side as well as Republicans standing there. And that essentially uncorked the bottle. So now we're left with the choice of deciding that they're about to go, we would not support them having that authority. And we concluded that, many of us concluded that, the best thing for us to do was to try to force the administration to the United Nations, giving them a strong hand, knowing that if the United Nations didn't step forward, that they would be authorized to go without the UN. But what happened, and I'll end with this, I'm sorry it takes so long, but it's an important point, I think, and that is that what happened was I didn't, and I don't think any of us anticipated how the administration's stated policy would be undercut by another part of the administration. At the very moment, Powell looked like he was going to get a second resolution. You had the vice president and you had the secretary of defense enunciating policies of preemption, which was not the basis. The resolution we passed explicitly said you could not go to war on a position of preemption. It was enforcement. We were enforcing UN resolutions. And every time we'd get close, you'd have Mr. Rumsfeld, Mr. Cheney, Mr. Wolfowitz casting this effort in a way that made it impossible, in my view, for Europeans to accept that. And that continued literally all the way through this process, including the post-Saddam planning, until very recently, until literally a week ago when the president authorized the Secretary of State, or 2 weeks ago, to go back to the United Nations. He got a 15-0 resolution, and it looks like that there's going to be an agreement about the donors conference. That's the place we're going this week to try to get the rest of the world to get in on the deal and help pay for this. We are apparently about to agree, which we should, that the money that comes up through that donors conference go to the United Nations and the World Bank for them to distribute, not go to the United States to distribute, which has been our position. So it looks like the president is taking charge now and rejecting Cheney and Rumsfeld's advice. But keep in mind, at every step of the way here, we're left with a choice that is usually two bad choices. And that's not to admonish ourselves of responsibility. There is responsibility on our part, mine as well. But the truth of the matter is that we should not have been expected to anticipate, and I'm going to say it, not Chuck, the incompetence of the post-Saddam planning here.
So, Senator Hagel, is this a U-turn if the White House has in hand its 15-0 U.N. resolution? If the White House is able to make the case later this week at the donors conference in Madrid, are we watching this dramatic U-turn to a multilateral administration?
Well, I'm not quite yet as bullish as Senator Biden is on this dramatic U-turn, I think.
Hopeful.
probably interestingly enough, I'm a Republican and he's a Democrat. But I think we are seeing signs that it's moving in the right direction, but I don't think we're quite there yet. For example, we did not give up an awful lot of responsibility sharing and decision-making sharing to get that 15-0 resolution. I obviously am glad we got it. Senator Biden, Senator Lugar, others, myself, have been pushing for a long time to frame this up in a multilateral effort so we would have the legitimacy of other nations with us. I think that's critically important. I applaud the president, and in particular Secretary Powell. But I'm not quite sure yet that the forces of the vice president and Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld have kind of shifted into the darkness of night here and never to be heard from again. I'm not quite sure the administration has made that U-turn toward multilateralism. There is only one way out of this for America, in my opinion, and that is to continue along a multilateral course, but at the same time move the Iraqis in a position as soon as possible for them to govern themselves, and then we have to get out. There's no other way out of this, and the expectation level must be tempered here as to what we're going to get out of the donors conference, and especially what kind of troop level we could expect from our allies. We're not going to get many troops from our allies. I don't know how much we get at the donors conference. I think if we tap out at $10 billion from the World Bank, Japan, European Union, others, we're going to be very lucky. That leaves a huge, huge gap here in additional resources. So we are a long way from the finish line, and the good news, again, I say, is that we are moving toward a multilateral effort.
Senator, I have to stop you there because we're going to step away for a short break. Connection listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255. Senator Joe Biden, Senator Chuck Hagel with us this hour asking some questions about what comes next in Iraq and willing to answer your questions as well. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. This hour, two senior members of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Senator Chuck Hagel, Republican from Nebraska, Senator Joe Biden, Democrat from Delaware. Connection listeners, a chance to dig in with these two on questions and questions that may not have answers for what's going on in Iraq. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's talk about specifically what it is that you two are looking for, because when we hear these questions put to Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld on how many troops should be there and how when the troops should come home. He says it's unknowable. When the questions are put on the money to members of the administration, how much is it really going to cost? The answer comes back. It's unknowable. So, Senator Hagel, start off. How are we going to measure success here?
Well, you measure success based on one outcome, and that is, will the Iraqi people be in a position to govern themselves? And it will be up to the Iraqi people to forge the kind of government that they want, develop their own economy. We can't impose an American Jeffersonian democracy on Iraq or any country. So the way you measure success is exactly, as in my opinion, as I said. How long that takes, certainly this is imperfect. It is a process that's unknowable to a certain extent, but where many of us drew the line here a year ago when we pushed hard for the administration to develop a post-Saddam plan for Iraq, which some of us had said publicly and very plainly that they didn't do that, or if they did do it, they didn't use the plan. Now we're finding out that there were some plans in the State Department that the Defense Department essentially just refused to acknowledge.
But that's the future of Iraq project.
Yes. Yeah. But back to your original question, what we have to do now is sustain the effort all the way through and move those Iraqi people into a position where they can govern as soon as they can, develop their own economy, and get us out. Because if we don't do that, I don't know how long we're going to be there. But at the same time, as I said earlier, and I know Senator Biden's been making this point, the administration has to be honest to the American people. We're going to have troops in there next year. We're going to have troops in there in 2005. I don't know how much longer after that we have them. I'm sure we will. There's no other way around this. And the American people must be prepared for a long, sustained effort. It's going to continue to take treasure and people and commitment and leadership from the United States.
All right, Senator Biden, though, I want to come back to what you were saying earlier about people feeling misled on this. There was a story in the weekend Washington Post saying that the number of U.S. soldiers would be down to 100,000 by the summer before the presidential election. You know all the stories about contracts that are being handed out to the Bechtels and the Halliburtons without any kind of bidding and contract. How can the administration make the case that it has answers to questions and persuade people that those are the right answers?
Just first of all, just level. No foreign policy can be sustained without the informed consent of the American people. And they have not informed the American people of what's at stake right from the very beginning. Dick, let me point something out to you. All of this was knowable. It was all knowable. And let me be very precise. The first thing the president has to do is begin to lead. And he has to lead by demonstrating he knows the difference between bad advice and good advice. He's gotten nothing but bad advice. I'm going to say that again. I know that's a bold thing to say. He's gotten nothing but bad advice so far from Mr. Cheney and Mr. Rumsfeld. And if he doesn't demonstrate to the world that he understands that the advice they've given him has led him into this box canyon, then he is not a leader.
But didn't the White House just 10 days ago say, look, this is not going the way we wanted it to. We're going to take control of the Iraq issue.
No longer
in the Pentagon, no longer in State Department.
It should be in the State Department, but that's exactly what Chuck was just saying. The president now is saying that. But this thing about unknowable, let's get a few things straight here. All of what was happening post-war was knowable. First of all, you had the State Department Iraqi project. They had 17 working groups. They predicted there would be looting, there'd be armed resistance, there'd be low oil production. Mr. Warwick, the guy that headed it up, when General Garner, the guy we first put in charge there, read Warwick's report, he asked that Warwick be the number two guy under him. Defense Department nixed it. The Pentagon itself in early 03 had a study showing the oil wasn't going to be there, and Shinseki talked about the need for hundreds of thousands of troops. The National Security Staff, the NSC at the White House, wrote a memo, whether the president saw it or not, I don't know, saying that there's a need for up to 500,000 troops. The Council on Foreign Relations said you shouldn't disband the Iraqi army. You need public diplomacy. There's not enough oil. The CSIS, everybody said this. So this was pure arrogance on the part of Mr. Rumsfeld and Cheney, concluding in their unilateral doctrine that they did not need, did not want, and did not seek anybody else's help. And the president signed on lock, stock, and barrel. Now, where Chuck and I are both, he's less hopeful than I am, I guess. I am hopeful that what we're seeing now is the president's rejection, recognition that that was bad advice, and a rejection of that advice. And here's how it's going to play out. We're going to know pretty soon whether or not, when we get down to the first point, when the Constitution comes back. If the Constitution comes back that's being written by the Iraqi people that the UN likes and we don't like, what are we going to do? If, in fact, we have these decisions early on in this new investiture in the outcome of the United Nations on things relating to diplomacy and things relating to who makes up the government.
Let me just hear from Senator Hagel here, though. Are you thinking that that this president will ever say, look, I got some bad advice, I took some bad decisions, we had a little bit of arrogance happening here, but we've got it in hand now?
He doesn't have to say that, but let me make it clear, Dick. I'm not saying he has to say that. I'm just saying he has to demonstrate it. Demonstrate it by rejecting this policy of unilateralism. That's what I'm saying.
Senator Hagel, let me hear from you on this.
Well, as I have said before, and I think Joe covered some of the specifics of your original question here as to what happened and what they didn't use and what was available, I think it's laid out pretty clearly. But let's start where we are, because where we are is where we are. This is October 20th. We the Congress has just passed an $87 billion supplemental. Now we've got to work out the fine print of that. The president's going to get the $87 billion, both for Reconstruction and our military use. Both Joe and I believe he should. Most of us did believe he should, and we voted that way. Now, what he does with that, how he uses the UN resolution to widen the participation of the international community now is going to be the real test, and we'll see what he does with it. I don't know where he's going to go with this, but we are very deep into something here that we have never been into before. It's a region of the world that's complicated, that's dangerous, that's uncertain. And the other part of this is it does connect to the Middle East peace process, to what's happening, or more accurately, what's not happening. We haven't paid enough attention to that, to the Israeli-Palestinian problem. What's happening in Afghanistan, we are right on the edge there. All these things are connected, woven into the same fabric. So this is an overall policy that the president is going to have to work through. And we can't do it alone. That is the point.
Let's get some of our callers in here now. Our number is 1-800-423-8255 to Nashua, New Hampshire. Susan's on the line. Hi, Susan.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, hear you fine. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you. I have a comment. I'll take the responses offline. I appreciate the two senators being willing to be on the front line today for this conversation. I'd like to echo what Dick Gordon said initially. My point is that I look as a citizen to the senior members of Congress, especially in the Senate, who have longer terms and longer tenure, to be stronger than you have been. Now, you have been, you know, willing to be on the front lines. I look at you as representatives of the senior tier in the Senate. And the senior tier has failed.
Susan, what do you want them to do that they're not doing?
The message I'm getting, which all makes perfect sense from the two senators today, especially Senator Hagel, that all of this could have been predicted. Well, of course it could have been predicted, not just by the administration, but by the senior members of the Senate. I predicted all of this, and I'm an average, well-informed citizen.
Okay, so bring us back to now. Are you saying that
senior tier accountable.
Susan, are you saying that they should not have voted for this $87 billion?
Right. And they and the votes prior to that, and while I applaud the bills that Senator Biden and others may have put in front of the administration that were rejected, and the Hobbesian choice concept, I understand, but I also understand that they should know how the game is played. And after all their years and tenure, should have known the moves that would have been made and anticipated them ahead of time. They have the years, they have the intelligence, they have the tenure, and they have the connections in Washington and around the world, and I do not know why
and Senator,
they would fail and would pass not, this. And we
let's
are
hear
now,
from the senators here, because and we'll start with Senator Biden here, that while you say, yes, I voted for the $87 billion with all these buts, when the president stands on a stage in his reelection campaign, he'll say, look, I had all this support for this move, and all the qualifications that go along with the support are somewhat lost. I wonder whether or not you take yourself out of the equation. Whenever a bill like this is presented, you say, yes, I support it. Are you not then out of the equation?
Well, you know, Dick, I think you're letting me off easy. Susan asked a much tougher question. Susan asked the question of why, in the very beginning, before we went to war, we didn't anticipate what was going to happen, and we didn't call the president on it. The fact is, we did anticipate it. The fact is, we did write a report. The fact is, as chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee in July of 2003, we wrote an extensive report pointing out that all of the things that was coming out in post-war Iraq were going to happen, and we should prepare for them, and we didn't appear to be preparing for them. In 2002, I should say. But what we ended up with is a little bit like where you're asking me now. Here we are in October 20th, 2003. We have on the ground about 150,000 people, all told in the region, closer to 200,000 people. We have committed in Iraq, and we've taken down a tyrant, and we've been left because of the bad policies that have been followed with a hornet's nest here that if it fails, we fail. This is one of the things I hold the president most accountable for. And I'll know whether he's made the U-turn, really, when he stops talking about Iraq only in terms of terror. If the Lord Almighty came down and said there won't be a single terrorist attack again for the next 5 years, we still have a multi-billion-dollar problem, and failure is still a catastrophe if we don't secure the peace in Iraq, because you'll have a country called Iran become the major dominant force in the region. You will see two failed states on either side there. You will see the prospect of Pakistan falling. You will see at least one other Arab state fall. The end of modernity that we're talking about in the Arab world will come prematurely, and the notion of democratization will be set back for two decades, and we will inherit the wind. So I'm left, Susan, with the prospect. I go ahead and I either decide to vote for the $87 billion and try to internationalize this so that we don't have failure, because if we don't vote for that money, if we pull out, there is absolute chaos in the region, including civil war. And that, to me, is an alternative that is totally unacceptable.
Senator Hagel, Susan is saying you should be doing more somehow.
Well, you heard, of course, Dick, what I said, and I assume Susan, when I said earlier in this program that I think the Congress does have to take some responsibility for not doing more. So I'm already on record agreeing with a general premise here. But let's go back to a couple points that Senator Biden just made, and I agree with everything he just said. This is an imperfect, imprecise process. This chairmanship of Senator Biden's last year on the Foreign Relations Committee, picked up then with Senator Lugar's chairmanship, we held countless hearings over the last year and a half in foreign relations. We had witnesses come before us, and it was spectacular. I think the best set of hearings maybe in 20 years in the Congress on all these issues we're talking about today. What are the options? What are the possibilities? What do we think will happen? So some of us were out there, and again, I take my fair share of responsibility and blame here for not maybe doing more. But some of us did do a lot, and we were out and getting our heads beat in by, and I was in particular by my own party, because I was probably the lead Republican for many months all alone on this, asking these questions and trying to find some solutions, working on a bipartisan basis. But that aside, we are where we are. What Senator Biden is saying here is critically important. We must look at the larger picture here, the complete picture of what's going on, especially in that region of the world. And these are imperfect processes, and we're at a time when we're kind of making it up as we go along here. No one has ever had to deal with what we are dealing with right now in the same kind of ways and the same dynamics. So, yes, we should take some responsibility, maybe should have done more, But we're doing everything we can, I think a lot of us, to try and get this back on track so that we win, because it's in the interest of the country.
Let me see if I can get someone else in here from Blountstown, Florida now. Albert's calling in. Hi, Albert.
Good morning. Thank you so much for taking my call. Senators, I appreciate your time on the show. Wednesday, October the 15th, CBSNews.com, 60 Minutes 2, did a special, and they featured Greg Kielman. I don't know which one of you gentlemen mentioned proliferation, but I'm sure Senator Biden, having been long tenure, is certainly familiar with who he is. He was the retiring director of the Office of Strategic Proliferation and Military Affairs. His office oversaw every piece of security, classified information coming in about Iraq, either for the military or the CIA.
Albert, what's your question?
My question is, why were we lied to? He came out point blank and said, from the beginning, we were lied to. All of the metal casings were not capable, and this is according to Oak Ridge, Tennessee, of being used to enrich uranium.
Albert, let's hear from Senator Biden. Your question.
I'll tell you why. And by the way, on this one, as Chuck Hagel will tell you, from the very beginning, I was on the record saying I do not believe at all the administration's assertion regard to weapons of mass destruction. At the time, as far back as a year ago, I did not believe it. Why did they hype it? The reason they hyped it is they took what is a 30% or 40% believable case and made it the case, is because they did not want to lose the opportunity to generate support for going to war in Iraq. The reason I supported going to war in Iraq was not the weapons of mass destruction. Here you had a guy who was a madman, had already gassed his own people, was a menace in the region, was an absolute tyrant, signed a peace agreement in 1991. If it had been 1919 when he was forced out of Kuwait, he would have been in Versailles signing it, flaunted every single international rule, and the international community did nothing about it. International rules are of no value unless they are enforced. And we are on the verge of about to lift sanctions against him, which was the alternative we had put ourselves in. And I have no doubt in my mind, with $1.8 billion left unfettered for 5 to 7 years, he would get a nuclear weapon. But I did not believe he had one then. I did not believe the aluminum pipes.
Question, Senator, why were we lied to, though?
The reason we were lied to was to get change the attitude in America about going to war. After Chuck and I held those hearings back in July, public support for the war dropped below 50%. The president came along and started this rush to every single thing was imminent, this notion of an imminent threat. There was no imminent threat. And the rationale to go to war with Saddam should not have been based on that. It should have been based upon the enforcement of the international agreements that this man solemnly signed onto. And remember, I remind Susan and others, if she's still listening, that the alternative was lifting sanctions at that point. Lifting sanctions against this tyrant and or enforcing the sanctions.
Senator, I have to stop you there. We're taking a brief break. Connection listeners, our telephone number 1-800-423-8255. A chance for your questions about Iraq and measuring success there with Senators Chuck Hagel and Joseph Biden. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. I'm Dick Gordon. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. With us this hour, Senators Joseph Biden and Chuck Hagel from the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. We're talking about Iraq, how this country measures success and holds the administration to account for the expenditure of the $87 billion that is in the process of being approved right now. And I must tell both of you, we have a number of callers who want to get in, so if I can ask you to keep your answers a little bit brief. Senator Hagel, I do want to hear briefly from you on whether or not you even think the country was lied to, as suggested in the last question.
No, I don't believe the country was lied to. Intelligence is imprecise, and it's all about analysis. But I do believe that this administration fit the intelligence into their overall policy objective. And I think there was some misrepresentation in it. And we'll see as we play it out, as we've already seen, and we will continue to see how what happened 6-12 months ago is a little clearer today than it was then. So I don't believe the administration intentionally lied to anyone.
All right, let's go to Columbia, South Carolina. Lisa is joining us now. Hi, Lisa.
Good morning.
Thanks for calling.
Can you hear me okay? I'm calling from a payphone.
Hear you fine.
Okay, great. Senators and Dick Gordon, I just had a quick comment. I was on the road when I heard the program. I pulled off and got in the payphone. I'm calling you from South Carolina because I'm staying with my in-laws. My husband's in Afghanistan and has been for over 3 months. I know many wives, many other military spouses whose husbands have been gone over 6 months now and have 6 months to go. My comment really was just to say that we perhaps weren't lied to, but we're not upfront about everything. We want our troops home as soon as possible, as I'm sure everyone does. But at this point, it just doesn't look like it's going to happen. And in fact, my husband and I were going to, you know, my husband's been in 6 years. We were going to stay in for 20, and now there's just no way. We want out.
Why, Lisa?
We just don't think that the support is there, that, you know, that everyone was upfront about this. I do not want to go through this again. I know many other military families do not want to go through this again. Many families have moved out of the military housing to enable to make a little bit more money, because money is always an issue being a military family.
Yeah.
I'm staying here in South Carolina so we can make a little extra, you know, money to do this. And, you know, we've just all uprooted our lives to do this. And it's a lot of stress. And I think 6 months should be a maximum deployment for any soldier. I think more than 6 months is just too much on their mental, their spiritual, and their physicalness. It's just too much for them.
Senator Hagel, let's hear from you on this.
Well, first, I want to thank the caller and her family and, of course, her husband for their commitment to this country. There's no question that families always take the hardest hit in this, so thank you. I think that comment and the overall commentary that we just heard is something the administration is going to have to start paying attention to. These are issues. These are real-life issues that we just heard from someone who's going through this with her husband and her family, that the administration didn't take into consideration. I have said, and I still say, and I feel it stronger today than I did a year ago or a half year ago, that if we're not careful here, we are on the verge of destroying our force structure in this country, our reserves, our National Guard components, the active duty component. Now, this lady's husband is active duty, and she just said they ain't coming back. And with an all-voluntary service here, we've got to be very careful what we're doing. And I don't think this administration factored any of those dynamics into it. And that's another dynamic that we haven't even talked about yet this morning, is the future of our force structure so that we can fulfill the commitments that we're making to our country and the world.
Senator Biden, what would you say to Lisa?
I'd say, Lisa, you were misled. I'd say, Lisa, a number of us over the last 6-8 months and every program from Meet the Press to Face the Nation to programs like this have been saying it's going to take a great deal more. What we're seeing here is the damage done by a policy of arrogant unilateralism, concluding that we don't need anybody else in the world. We can only do it ourselves. We'll do it ourselves, and that's it. And it is pure, pure arrogance. It is also a failed policy. And I hope to God what happens now is that we recognize that and begin to rebuild relations around the world. Remember, Lisa, immediately after 9/11, you had France, you had all of NATO invoking what they call Article 5, saying an attack on the United States on 9/11 was an attack on all of us, them offering to send forces to Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. I went to Afghanistan. I think I was the first or second guy in Afghanistan, in both Bagram and in Kabul. And at the time, every military person we had there said, we want international help. But the Pentagon said we did not want international help. We did not want to expand the security force in the region. Translated, we stiff-armed the rest of the world. You had Germany and the Mr. Schroeder, the Chancellor of Germany. You wonder why we have bad relations. For the first time in the history of Germany after World War II, getting a vote by one vote. He almost lost his government by one vote to send 1,000 German Marines to Afghanistan. And Mr. Rumsfeld said, we don't need you. And so we're
Senator,
paying a horrible price for that.
Let's just hear once again from Lisa, because, Lisa, you're listening to a Republican senator and a Democratic senator saying here that the president needs to do more. He needs to take charge of the issue. He needs to start giving answers to questions that aren't being answered. If that were to happen, would your own attitude change, or have you had it? Are you fed up?
I've had it, but, you know, I'm a hopeful person, and I hope that America has sense enough in next year. I hope this time next year that we have a different leader, to be honest with you, and someone that is ready to promote peace rather than jump and bridge war, because war begets war, violence begets violence, and there's no answers in that. Just like the other senator said, you know, they had someone that was willing to send our troops and support us, and they didn't want to do it. So I'd be sorry to go. My husband loves his job. He does a wonderful job, and I love the community of it, but I also want peace in my own life. So there have to be a lot of changes.
Lisa, give our best regards to your husband, will you?
Thank you so much.
Thanks for calling. Nice to have you on the program. 1-800-423-8255 to Norfolk, Massachusetts. Now Bob's with us. Hi, Bob.
Good morning, and good morning to Senator Grassley and to my former classmate, Senator Biden.
No, it's Chuck Hagel, Senator Biden.
I'm not worthy of being referred to as Senator Grassley.
Well, I had the radio down low.
We're all out there in the middle somewhere, out in Iowa and Nebraska. We run together.
Go ahead, Bob.
I'm sorry. I'm concerned about the impact of our actions in Iraq upon bin Laden and the Al-Qaeda organization. Back in the early 90s, the Democrats often used a slogan, it's the economy, stupid. I would suggest that in the coming year, they might want to use the slogan, it's Al-Qaeda, stupid. These are the people who slaughtered 3,000 American civilians. And
Bob, you're not buying the argument that Iraq has become the place where terrorists are gathering?
May be some truth to that, but I think, as has been pointed out in this program, that Iraq was not an imminent threat to the United States,
right,
and should have been a much lower priority. Higher priorities, certainly at the top, has to be Al-Qaeda, and certainly underneath that has to be the nuclear threats posed in North Korea and perhaps in the Middle East as well. And we spent treasure and energy in Iraq, and it seems to me that it has taken the appropriate energy and treasure that should have been devoted to pursuing Al-Qaeda. I mean, those are the people when they declare an orange alert in the United States. I didn't think of Saddam Hussein. I thought of Osama bin Laden, and we've taken our eye off the ball there.
But Senator Biden, what would the United States do now with the troops in Iraq? I mean, I hear you in the background agreeing with Bob, but
well, I do agree with Bob. At the time, even before and then, I kept being asked in every program like yours, Dick, what I thought the greatest threat was, because I was getting the living devil kicked out of me by the administration, because I said Korea is a much more imminent threat, much greater danger to us than Iraq is. And further, that this notion of our taking our eye off the ball. If you ask the commanding general in the field in Iraq whether or not we are most likely, or General Abizay, he was asked before the Armed Services Committee, is a terrorist attack likely to emanate from terror out of Iraq? He said no. It's going to come from some other part of the world. It's going to come from Indonesia or the Sudan or West Germany or somewhere else. So the idea that the president keeps saying to the American people that we either fight them in Baghdad or we fight them here implies that even though there are terrorists gathering in Baghdad, that somehow that is the locus of the threat to us in the United States is very, very misleading. And we tried, including Senator Hagel and a number of us on that committee, to get the administration to focus on what were greater threats at the time. Now, it doesn't mean we can't walk and chew gum at the same time. The idea that Saddam Hussein was some kind of benign character who wasn't a danger and a destabilizing force in the region is also not true. He was, and he still is, I might add.
Senator, let me, if I can, elbow in here and see if we can squeak one more call in before the balance of the hour, too. Where are we now? Rocky Mountain, North Carolina, and Ben's on the line. Hi, Ben.
Hey, how you doing? I'm just served 21 years in the service, Air Force fighter pilot. $87 billion is a drop in the bucket compared to the amount of money we spent the past 10, 11 years since the end of Desert Storm to contain this madman that was over there.
You're saying this is money well spent then, Ben?
Yes, I would serve for this president anywhere, anytime, any place. He stands for what he means. He's a good man. He's a good Christian. And we've done the right thing. I know there's people dying over there, and that's sad, but you know, it's something that should have been done years ago. 99% of the fighter pilots and Air Force pilots, we spend $6 to $10 million to train, and I'm talking thousands of these guys, have gotten out of the service because of having to spend 3 to 9 months a year over in Northern Watch or Southern Watch the past 12 years.
You're saying this is an end to the no-fly zone, and it ought to be seen in that sense. Ben, I want to thank you for your call. And Chuck Hagel, you know that there are a lot of people in this country who think that what the president's doing is exactly the right thing, and that for you as a Republican senator to say, hey, you got serious questions about it, even that's being a little rough on the guy.
Well, it's not being rough on the president at all. I fail my country if I don't ask the tough questions, and I fail my country even more if I don't help provide solutions. So that's my job, and I take that job seriously, just like Senator Biden does and others. But one last point here, and I know you want to wrap this up. What we have failed to do over the last year, and I think the guests that you've had on this morning focus right on it, we didn't ever ask the question that always must be asked, then what happens? What happens next? We didn't ask that question, and we're paying a high price, and we'll continue to pay a high price for that. It's complicated, yes, we have a long way to go, but transparent, honest leadership is always the central core issue in any policy to sustain that policy as well.
And Senator Biden, it's one thing to say it's time to leave Iraq when the Iraqis are ready to run their own country, but who makes that call? I mean, is
right
this going
now,
to be done on a presidential call, election schedule? Who makes that decision?
Well, I hope it's not done on a presidential election schedule. Practically, it may be. But now that call is going to be made by the international community, because we made a commitment in that UN resolution that passed 15 to nothing that within 1 year after there is an Iraqi government in place, we will be gone unless they ask us to stay, and we conclude to be. So that decision will be made by the Iraqi people the moment they, in fact, have a constitution and a general election. And the international community will make the judgment whether or not that constitution is written properly and there is a fair election. And I want to make it clear, we can still win the peace. We just need to stay the course in internationalizing this, keep investing the rest of the world in this, because winning the peace is critical, critical for the safety of our children and our grandchildren. If that nation fails, we are in serious, serious difficulty internationally.
Senator Hagel, is this administration ready to internationalize this in the way that Senator Biden's suggesting?
There are positive signs that they are doing that, evidenced by the resolution last week, the hard work that Secretary Powell put into getting that resolution. I hope they continue down that path because, just as Senator Biden said, and as I said earlier in the program, that's the only way out for us. That's the only future we have in the world. These threats are global threats. They will require global responsibilities and responses from all of our allies.
Senator Hagel, thank you so much for being with us on the program.
Thank you.
Senator Chuck Hagel, Republican from Nebraska. Senator Biden, good to hear from you. Thanks for your help.
Thank you very much, Dick.
Senator Joseph Biden, Democrat from Delaware, both of them senior members of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Connection listeners, you're welcome to continue the conversation in the forum section of our website. We're at theconnection.org. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.